You'll be happy to know that Jonah rushed in the door, managed to knock down an IPA just in time before the broadcast, which had to start exactly at 6 o'clock.
Yeah, exactly at 5. We don't want you to get too drunk before you go get your hamburger. Mm-hmm. Okay, so on Western Thought, see, now it's going to sound canned though, because now I've already repeated it to myself a couple times. On Western Thought, sometimes we actually talk about the West. Is that like interesting for podcasts, or are podcasts supposed to be more like off the cuff? Now it sounds like I'm a presenter of some kind.
But it does behoove us to you know, examine the ethos of the West.
Right.
Since this is Western Thought.
That was the better way
periodically
to say it. Yeah. Ethos. Yeah. Right. A good word like ethos, right, helps, right, helps out. Right. So we're going to talk about finding Everett Ruiz, or just about Everett Ruiz in general, I guess, or the West, and poetry and beauty and all that good shite.
And how getting lost is part of the West, right?
Mm. Getting lost on purpose?
Getting lost on purpose. You who have been with me out on the big desert know that I love to get lost.
Yeah.
It's just like disorientation is one of my favorite things.
You know, it's weird. Well, Everett died when he was 20, right?
Oh,
he didn't even reach 21.
Oh my gosh, I know.
And died in mysterious circumstances that this book is trying to like work back from and understand. Perhaps some of you might recognize him specifically from John Krakauer's book Into the Wild, because he had a chapter on Everett Ruiz and that. And that's where I recognized his name. When you first handed me the book, I was like, oh, this is that chapter from Krakauer's.
Really? I didn't know that.
Well, basically, he's making a bunch of comparisons about how Christopher McCandless, the Into the Wild guy, the Alaska guy, him and Everett Ruiz shared this same sense of, like, they just didn't want to abide by these certain social norms, and they just want to be involved with beauty, and they're both young and
so did McCandless, was he an artist or writer?
Yeah, kind of, yeah, but I would argue maybe that Everett Ruiz was more of an artist, because he was actually a painter, and he like sought out famous painters like we were talking about, and photographers.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. It's going to be hard for me to say Everett Ruiz, because I've always said just Ruiz. But,
oh, yeah, yeah. Ruiz might be better.
But,
I don't know.
But,
it's more American.
But no, he was a fantastic block print artist. Took lessons from Maynard Dixon, the greatest Western painter of all time, including Charlie Russell and Remington and Vogel, Shry Vogel, and all these guys. No, he's a fantastic artist, and as you learn in A Vagabond for Beauty, his diaries are fantastic, man. I mean, he's a fantastic writer, you know, in the vein of Thoreau, you know.
Right, yeah.
But you can see that, you know, in the last page of A Vagabond for Beauty, there's a poem by Edward Abbey, you know, a eulogy to him, a paean to him, in which you can tell that he really influenced Edward Abbey's lyric feeling for the desert, you know. So,
wait, I thought Edward Abbey came before Everett.
No. Oh, no.
No, yeah, he came after.
No, much, much later. Much later.
When was Edward Abbey's first book published?
Ruiz is the...
dies in 1934.
Was like 1917 or something, and Edward Abbey was born in 26, I believe. 26
oh,
or
okay.
27.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And but that's a big 10 years in terms of... but yeah, I was impressed, you know, reading Vagabond for Beauty, how influential Everett was on all these desert rats and conservationists. And of course he also hung out with Ansel Adams.
Yeah.
So I mean,
well,
it's
yeah,
pretty deep in him.
Well, it's the chapter in Finding Everett Ruiz is that he's showing up on their doorsteps in San Francisco.
Yeah, yeah.
They all live in San Francisco, and he's just showing up on their doorsteps, which for me is remarkable on a couple of levels, not least of which is that you know where their doorsteps are. Like, what? Like, how was he getting this information? That's kind of what boggles my mind a little bit.
Well, both Ansel Adams and Dixon had studios.
Right.
So that was easy.
See, okay.
Yeah.
Their studios are are published.
Yeah, but you're right. That's a good point, Jonah, that no, he did not show up on their doorstep, and you know, which would be a little intrusive, right?
Well, yeah. But he was 19 when he's doing it.
But he's also a very precocious genius. I mean, there's no doubt he's a genius, man.
Yeah.
And again, I'm so glad that you brought up that we should kind of look at this, is that I was astonished, one, how good his writing is, how good his diaries are, how good his letters are. He mastered the genre of the diary and the letter, you know, and the self-consciousness of writing a letter that's got some pretty cool stuff in it, right?
Well, I think it's that perfect blend of intelligence and adolescence, right?
Exactly.
I mean, like,
exactly.
It's not like he was so good. It's just that he was, when you look back on it, it's kind of like when people get fascinated by concert pianists who are 18 years old or something. You know, it's like, yeah, it's like amazing for their age. You know, there's always the qualification for
it. And it has a freshness. You're right. I mean, I didn't notice any cliches he might have written were kind of well written. So I thought, well, great. You know?
Unless you consider all writing an essentially cliched exercise. I mean, or all writing of...
That's pretty Frenchy. That's pretty Frenchy there, man. That's pretty... Arnaud, who was just reading that today, that all literature is just a...
You're a Shakespeare scholar.
...refiguration of other protocols.
Right.
So...
Nothing new under the sun.
But you're right. When a 19-year-old, 18-year-old kid writes like this and writes really well. I'm just saying he writes really well.
Yeah.
And but that was what was fun to kind of see, was that yes, he was ambitious. Yes, he went and contacted these famous people, which you and I, Jonah, would never do.
Well, I don't even know who I'd go to anymore. I mean, specifically, I think one is given the benefit of being a painter or something like that, where, you know, you could go and learn a technique. I think with writing, you got to be kind of a little hard-headed. I mean, or like when I was really, I think when I was 22, I was like, and I realized Kundera was still alive, I was like, I should go to France and talk to him. But then I was like, but what is he going to tell me that's going to be more sophisticated than what was in his books? You know, it's like, that's why you write the books.
Which is exactly how you learn, absolutely. Right.
But with a painter, it's different, because it's like, you can't look at a painting and say, okay, I moved my hand like this to create this. You know, it's a little bit more of a technique.
Very good point, because that is a lot like musicianship. I have watched Andrew Wills. He's got a little curl with the right hand on certain accents. I had never seen that before, and I picked that up. So you're absolutely right. Painting and music, or the performance, are a lot alike. Absolutely, man.
Yeah.
But again, you've got to look at, he wandered on the scene in California. Of course, he grew up in L.A., and he realizes the action's up in San Francisco, and he goes up there. I mean, he was at a point in time where the action was there and the teachers were there. And again, Maynard Dixon gave him a painting lesson, and it's pretty spectacular, man.
I gotta look through some of Maynard Dixon's paintings. I'm impressed if whether your knowledge of Western painters has something to do with your age, or if it's something specific to you. Like,
it's my age, absolutely. Yeah. I've been in the bookstore here for 30 years, and I've picked up books on Western art, and for me to throw off the word Schreivogel is pretty damn astonishing to me. But no, I specialize in Western art, and so I'm learning a little bit, and I can tell you Maynard Dixon is like better than anybody, and I mean, when you see his stuff, it's just so inimitable. And when you see Ansel Adams' stuff, it's so inimitable. And when you see Edward Weston's stuff, it's so inimitable. You know, and these people are right there alive. I mean, he was born at the time. And again, before, you know, before we get, I forget, is that he's kind of exposed to these people. And he's like 17 or 18 years old. It's a great story. I mean, this is the great loss. Mozart lived to be like 28 anyway.
Right, yeah.
I mean, this was a great loss, shock to all these people, because they knew how good he was. And all of a sudden, he's gone, man. And you look at the country that he traversed, where I have been down there, and just after two or three beers, just kind of in May, just walked across. The way that country holds heat is stupendous. I mean,
and we should say this is specifically this area of like northern Arizona, the tip of Colorado, like that Four Corners area,
San Juan country, and yeah. North of the it's Escalante. Escalante's big in the book, I realize,
right.
And that's the northeast, northwest corner of the Colorado where it goes through. And he's traversing all that on foot with no backup at all, man.
Well, except for two donkeys. Okay.
Yes, true.
Yeah.
Which is so charming.
Yeah, well,
his relationship with those donkeys is so great.
Well, it works, and it makes sense to me too, because it's like, you know, if you're really going to be somebody who's trying to examine the beauty of the natural world, and like you've got a 50-pound pack on your back.
Right.
There's just, it's impossible. You're just, like, especially in that hot day, you're just sweating. Like, you got to be drinking water constantly. Like, all you're thinking about is survival. But if you've got a couple donkeys at your back that can carry everything, carry your painting supplies and all that stuff.
Right, right.
So that was an important facet of it, too, I think.
But, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And isn't that, I'm going to bring a mythological aspect into this.
Please.
He's got the animal helpers. You're right. When we go into the craters of the moon, and as you know, whether in the Huapai Flow or at the northern craters, the further you go south from either nexus, you just go deeper into wilderness, and it just keeps getting more and more wilderness, you know, and it's more and more interesting, but it's not changing in terms of view, you know. It's just that you're getting tired, and you have to get back, you know.
Right.
But it gets more and more gorgeous, right? And you're absolutely right. That's the limiting factor, and he solves this, you know. And what a brilliant kid, though, if you think about that. He's going, yeah, how did the miners do it? Well, they had burrows.
Yeah, well, except for, you know, they did have certain problems. I mean, I remember one thing of their he said he was trying to get this one burro to cross a bridge, I forget over which river, but it I remember this line because it's so sort of visceral. He said the donkey left a bloody track across the whole bridge just because he was trying to dig his hooves in the whole way, and like, you know, because they're so skittish about crossing things like that, and rivers they're particularly bad at crossing rivers.
Right, but bridges are worse. Yeah. Donkeys are smart, man, and that's kind of like the, you know, that myth of these Indians that would get drunk up in, on the Montana reservations, and it just would happen a lot that you got an Indian would end up with his car buried into the far bank, where he could have just easily crossed the bridge. But they figured out that something primeval in them saw the bridge and didn't keep going across it. Just kind of said, well, I'll avoid the bridge. It just doesn't look real to me, right? And that's true. It's happened a lot up there, right? So, oh, that's a great, yeah. Well, my point is made. He's a really good writer. That little vignette just really sticks with you, you know?
Yeah. Bloody trail,
man, I gotta get a damn burrow if I'm gonna explore the craters of the moon, man. That's just, come on.
Yeah,
I need an animal helper.
I wonder how much one would cost you now, and that was one of the details in 19 1933, he got one for $6. You know what cost more than his donkey? A tarpaulin, which cost $8. Now you could probably get a tarpaulin for $8 still.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. Oh, that's tremendous.
It's kind of funny.
Yeah.
But there's a, I mean, there are certain detractors to him too, who kind of found him a naive adolescent who, you know, goes out on his own and dies. You know, it's like there is that too. I mean, for people who live to be of old age, is he puts himself out there and he does die. So there's that consequence as well.
But you know, the segue there is this ethos of the Western rock climber. You know, these rock climbers that just put them out, or the kayakers that are just putting themselves out there, man. No, he's a patron saint. I think Everett is going to be sainted.
Well, that's a good lead into. So I know we both have problems with Wallace Stegner, but one of my favorite bits of this was seeing Stegner be this critic, but also Stegner wrote a piece about Everett Ruiz in 1946 or something like that, and so he quotes from him a couple times here, and it made me appreciate Wallace Stegner, who has written more stuff than probably deserved to be published ever, but I think that's both of our problems with him. Like that book I just got from you is like, well, I'll come back to that. But what he wrote is, "It is just possible that the loss of identity is the price of immortality. Because Everett Ruiz is immortal, as all romantic and adventurous dreams are immortal, he is and will be for a long time artist in residence in the San Juan country." You know, it's like
beautiful.
I'll read another quote. But that was
beautiful.
That was the ending quote. But deliberately, he punished his body, strained his endurance, tested his capacity for strenuousness. He took out deliberately over trails that Indians and old timers warned him against. He tackled cliffs that more than once left him dangling halfway between talus and rim. With his burros, he disappeared into the wild canyons and emerged weeks later, hundreds of miles away, with a new pack of sketches and paintings and a whole new section in his journal and a new batch of poems.
Right. Wallace Stegner was the greatest nonfiction writer of the West. I accept that.
He's just a little bit repetitive.
It's when he writes about other people and his nonfiction and his, like, the beautiful cadenced sequence of images, he's fantastic. He's a great writer. It's just when he writes fiction that it's just like, oh, come on, Wallace, man. You just spent too long in a university, man. You really haven't had a life. But he's a hell of a writer. Man, that's really good stuff
there. Well, he has like a, what do they call, hypergraphia or something. Like he has one of those, he's one of those guys who David Foster Wallace always accused of John Updike. It seemed like he never had an unpublished thought. You know, it's like that's the same thing with Wallace Stegner. But
what's interesting is how that phrase starts out with a slight reservation and then ends up with this beautiful, you know, kind of, you know, accolade, you know. And he says exactly so much better than I did just a minute ago. That's it right there, you know. So it's like he kind of, by his death, he kind of like possesses the Four Corners area in our imagination.
Yeah, and the mystery of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because people are more fascinated with mystery than they are with truth. And that's part of the problem with this book, in my opinion, is just how much mystery is trying to delve into and then trying to find, and then at the end, he realizes he doesn't want to find it, and then they think they find it, but then somebody proves them wrong,
Well, David Roberts is the ultimate Eastern publishing insider that writes 40 fucking books about the West,
right? Well.
And they're all slick. He wrote one about Combe Ridge, which I've been on parts of, right?
Huh.
And but he name drops. He
Well,
always
that's part of this too, with Combe Ridge,
yeah,
right?
southern Combe Ridge,
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
the south of the San Juan is in there too, yeah. And that, I think that was, I think Roberts talks about that's how that was the beginning of this book. He and another famous Western writer decide they're going to hike the Combe Ridge all the way from the south to the north, which is about 100 miles, right? And so they get the idea. And that's the connection he makes with the old Navajo that says the Utes, he saw these dastardly Utes, sworn enemies of the Navajo. A Navajo would never kill a nice white kid like Everett Roos. And of course, in A Vagabond for Beauty, Rufo nails, or at least throws suspicion on, three Navajo renegades that are traveling south, that have been up hunting deer, poaching deer, and meet Roos, and he figures he could have accompanied them south, and then they robbed him south. But it's still a heck of a mystery, man. I mean, he leaves the burros north of the Colorado
Yeah,
on
in
a
Davis Gulch, where they're found.
in Davis Gulch, and but there's no camping equipment or anything,
Right.
which points to the fact that he could have, if it weren't stolen, right?
Yeah, right.
But since they never found the body there, it kind of points to what Rufo says. These three Navajos say, well, let's just cross the river and we'll go down into Navajo land, and you won't have to worry about these burros anymore, right? And it kind of points to that in a way. At least it gets him across the river
Yeah.
and into northern Arizona and Navajo, the Navajo reservation.
Yeah.
So no, there, that's the one. But I mean, it's, if you read all the mysteries I do, it's got all the great, you know, it's all got all the great clues. It's just where, what do the clues mean, right? So anyway, gentle reader, he leaves the burros in a corral in Davis
Well,
Gulch.
but the guy who finds the burros, apparently his story is kind of inconsistent, and he was kind of a loser, halftime bandit of his own right.
Right,
So, like,
right,
his story isn't necessarily
right,
completely believable
right,
either.
right,
Like, where exactly he found them. Like, maybe he said he found them there, but he was
right.
lying about it, or,
Oh,
you
interesting.
know, like,
He wasn't accompanied by these other guys.
yeah, he found them by himself, yeah.
Oh, I didn't. I must have skimmed over that too fast. So anyway, Roberts's book assumes that Everett crossed the Colorado, where the Glen Canyon Dam now is inundated, and that's the other point Joan and I were really interested in. This is the ultimate conspiracy theory. If you're going to murder somebody because he's a conservationist, you flood his grave. You flood every place that he was. You flood the scene of the crime, man.
It's like if you're gonna make a Hollywood movie these days, there you'd get the business guys in suits, and they're like, "Oh, he's found our plans. We'll bury him there, and then the dam will
Then
cover it."
flood it, man.
And
Yeah,
yeah.
exactly. So that's the plot of Roberts' book, is that Everett is coming back from the south, going north towards the San Juan, when he sees a young white kid fleeing
Yeah, this old
three
Indian.
Utes.
This old Indian sees this kid fleeing, yeah, these Utes. And then when he sees the kid get murdered by these Utes, and then he's concerned that there's, like, you know, there's these agents patrolling the Navajo, and he's worried if they find out that somebody's been murdered on their land, then they'll have a scandal. So he rushes down and he buries the body in this cranny, in this crook. And this is a story he tells basically on his deathbed. Or he tells it to his daughter, because he contracts some disease. So he goes to a Navajo shaman who says, "You have to go back to the body and get a piece of hair, and then we need to burn that hair over 2 days, and there needs to be a cleansing ceremony." So the daughter witnesses this, and then she tells her brother, and her brother thinks about this, and he's like, he hears about Everett Ruiz, and he's like, "Oh, white boy being murdered right around the area where Everett Ruiz could have been." So they find this body, and not to give away the ending of Roberts' book, but he gives it away at the beginning. They think they find Everose's body in this cranny as a hasty burial, and they find all the reasons to think why it could have been his. But then there's still these burrows in Davis Gulch, which is like 100 miles away from where they find the body. And then it turns out that the DNA is a Navajo Indian. So it was never him, and so the mystery still continues. Basically the too long didn't read version of...
And this is how David Roberts sells a book.
Yeah.
Right. He says, well, you know, it's basically all a sham, but... It's got a lot of background information. Yeah.
Well,
so
he was,
fun. Yeah.
I mean, he was interested in it, and he acknowledges in his own way that, you know, perhaps they were being a little bit publicity seeking or whatever. It's like they held a big conference in like 1999 or whatever. An outdoor magazine held a conference. They're like, we finally found Everett's bones. And then later it turns out, no, we didn't. But
he gets his mojo from Outside Magazine, which is so it's. Yeah, no, I'm not a big fan of David Roberts. His stuff is pretty thin. He gets a book, man. He figures out how to make a book.
Yeah,
of 340 pages.
See, I want to be mean to David Roberts, but since you are, now I have to. I feel the necessity
sorry.
To defend.
Sorry,
him.
Jonah.
Like I'd specifically mark this passage where I was like. So he's talking about Everett when he was a young man. He said, there's no evidence that Everett tried to land a steady job. In a UCLA essay, he sneered like a Nietzschean Ubermensch. Work is a malevolent goddess, made impossibly conceited by unlimited and tempered flattery. When I am bowled over and trampled upon by the contemptible fools who rush madly to cast themselves upon her pyre, my face flushes to the roots of my hair. But I do not look back to see the evil leer in the eyes of the thwarted goddess as I pick myself up, flick decorously at my smirched clothes, and thread my way past the pitiable throng swarming to her sacrificial altar. And then Dave Roberts picks up, a sense of entitlement unmistakably runs through such grandiose pronouncements. And I'm like, motherfucker! You're calling Nietzsche sneering. First of all, that means you don't understand Nietzsche. And like give the kid his like poetic benefit of the doubt there, you know.
Exactly.
Like,
he's 18 years
old.
Man.
Like,
fuck
him. And he's not wrong.
Right?
You know, it's like
no.
What he's saying.
And that's why they
wrong.
Might have flooded his grave, man.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, he saw him, man. He saw him with what they was. Yeah.
Sneering like a Nietzsche.
Yeah, I don't like that. I don't like that opening line. Well, that's what he's a mediocrity, man.
Well, I think what it boils down to is just being afraid that somebody who reads your book, it's like it's low. I mean, lowest common denominator isn't what it is. It's more like making sure you don't offend anybody. So I'm gonna play both sides. I'm gonna print the thing he wrote
mm-hmm.
for the people who like that thing,
mm-hmm.
but I'm also gonna preface it with a. Like saying Nietzsche sneers at people, which is a complete misunderstanding of Nietzsche. It's like, that's why Krakauer is a better writer than David Roberts.
No, absolutely.
David.
Well, I mean, he's from Massachusetts, you know, but he's done like 40 books, and every one I read, I just kind of think, God, what a mediocrity, man.
Yeah, but it's like a nice kind of mediocrity. Like, in a sense, like, I blew through that book.
Right.
Without trouble at all.
Oh, I know.
You know,
no trouble at all.
Like,
yeah,
because you just you can blow through it without
right,
even being.
Yeah, no, and that's his shtick, man. And but yeah, you know, and again, you know, the whole thing about the critic. Again, that's what we revolt against is that he's being a critic of Everett Roos. Gratuitously.
Kind of. Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't even have to be.
Yeah, yeah.
This is an 18-year-old kid with, yes, I agree, it's a pretty purple passage, but there is evil in the world in California. I mean, he's seeing it, man. I mean, he's seeing them bulldoze everything, man.
Mm.
You know, and, yeah.
Well, and I think he has a point as an artist or a poet. It's like, once you see that beautiful, there's a million words to describe it, but the essence of beauty outside yourself, that dissolving of ego, whatever you want to call it, that that you can't really go back. I mean, there's no really going back after that. I don't know. I could probably phrase that better. But.
You cannot say that better, Jonah. That was worth the whole broadcast, man. That's absolutely true. Some people do go back. They always regret it, right?
Really?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of people they taste the milk of paradise, you know, like Coleridge said, and then they turn away from it and they're dispirited from then on, right?
Uh-huh.
And you're exactly right. And I think that's the point of the two personalities between Everett Ruiz and David Roberts. One's always going back to Massachusetts and his, you know, his nice little connections and everything.
Yeah.
And,
but, I mean, one might argue, as the book does, is like, you know, if it wasn't for perhaps somebody like him or who were a vagabond for Beauty.
Rufo.
Rufo, yeah. Both of them are pretty commercial writers. I mean, Rufo only gets it when he only starts writing it when he gets a commission to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so... I mean, there's a few sort of like charlatans who contact the family. That's a big part of Robert's book is like how much stuff, how many of his classic journals they gave away to these guys who said they were going to write a book or like do a screenplay and then never sent them back. And
interesting.
Feign ignorance and then just like hold on to the journals because they think they're going to be worth money and
interesting,
you know, stuff like that. Which,
is also a subplot of the Rufo book where. Where these guys say, "Yeah, we're going to find your son," and they milk the old man for money. Yeah, another interesting. There are a lot of interesting dimensions to it between the two books. Every book's got their good, you know, their good and their bad sides. It's not like I don't like Roberts. He's a shill man. I mean, he's got the connections and he produces.
Yeah.
And he's a journalist.
Well, okay, what is the etymological background of shill?
I do not know. All I know is that I met this cute blonde once upon a time, and she told me her name was Shill, and I went and made the mistake of saying, and she said, "My daddy named me." And I went, okay. And I, of course, in my youth and innocence, told her what shill meant, and... it's the person that keeps the game going, but somebody else is going to take the fall. The dealer is going to keep the money. The shill's going to keep the money. But there's somebody that's going to take the fall.
I thought the shill took the fall.
No, the shill takes the good cards. In other words, if you're in a game, you hit to try and take the aces or, you know, the money cards, right?
Huh.
And you'll hit to go broke betting a buck. And you'll take all the good cards, and then the person to your left, as counterclockwise, the person left clockwise of you suddenly.
Has this been a plot in a Western novel? Have you read a lot of Westerns? I feel like this has got to be a minor plot point in a Western
novel. I just gambled a lot when I was a kid.
Did you? Oh, yeah, that's right. You used to tell me that you knew this guy who was like a mafia connection around.
But I also, you know, gambled a lot, and that was. And somebody told me that. So whenever I was sitting in a game, I would look to my left and see if there was kind of a guy not betting much and playing.
Paranoia starts early.
No, it's the person to your right of you.
Right. Yeah. I was going to correct you, but
yeah,
I was like,
you.
It's not.
You should have. But
I was like, it's not really.
I would have come to it sooner or later.
Yeah.
But yeah, you look to the right. If there's a guy to the right to you that's taking hits, not betting much. And taking up a lot of cards, right?
But how many people have ever been to private games? I've never been to a private game in my life.
Well, this isn't Vegas. It can be anywhere. It could be any card
game
anywhere.
No, it has to be a private game. I mean, they're not going to do that at a casino, are they?
Are you kidding? Of course they do, man.
Really?
Of course they do.
Well, they'd have to be a higher roller table than whatever I was playing at.
We got to take that road trip to Jackpot, even though there are no strippers there for you to interview. For chapter two.
I think I milked that too.
Oh no, you didn't, man. You just you just, we're only in Reno. You've got to do more of a, you know, a wider sampling.
It should be a book.
Even though it was hard on your body.
It should be a book.
Staying up all night drinking cheap liquor and smoking cigarettes stay awake to talk to these babes, man.
It was hard, actually. When I was driving back, that was the hardest drive I've ever had. I honestly felt like I was going to vomit. And, like, I constantly felt like I was going to lose consciousness the whole time I was driving from Reno. I was like, Jesus, I'm getting too old for this.
That's great. Yes, remember Arista Strippers. That's what we love about Western thought.
Yeah.
It is nothing if not eclectic.
Well, so many people are...
Ecumenical.
Like, ecumenical. Yeah. Well, that would be an ecumenical matter. Okay, so I'm going to get back into it. This is one of the other things I've got saved. Okay, so there's also a through line of people trying to guess if Everett's gay or not. If he was a homosexual.
Really?
Because he's like, he had this long extended journey with this one friend, and this one friend he wrote, apparently he's most intimate letters to, but he has a moment where he's with a girl, and he writes her a couple love letters, and then he writes a longing farewell note, which I thought was perfect adolescent diary type. To be very kind to Dave Roberts now, I'm sure he went through a ton of material, and that picking out stuff that works in a book is actually incredibly complicated and hard, I'm sure. But it is from Everett's letter to the one girl. He said, "I was sorry, though, that our intimacy, like many things that are and will be, had to die with a dying fall. I do not greatly mind endings, for my life is made up of them. But sometimes they come too soon or too late, and sometimes they leave a feeling of regret, as of an old mistake or an indirect futility." Which is so perfect for, like, a 20-year-old to write. It's like, that's what I would have written when I was 20-year-olds, right? And it's like, and then your failings and your ideas of failings are so minuscule compared to a lifetime. Right. But they feel so on the surface. They're right there, and you can interact with them in a way.
Indirect futility.
Yeah.
I don't know. All I know is that, this is the point, man, is that T.E. Lawrence, you're 20 years old, and you're just going to go in the desert for 6 months instead of going into bars and trying to get laid?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
To leave the flood of life? But, I mean, that is a pure, what's the word? Gratuitous observation. I mean, he's a genius. He's a precocious genius, man. And both writing and his graphic work, I think. And so he goes, yeah, I'm going to turn my back on women, man. That's what he did. So,
yeah,
you know.
Endings. My life has been a series of endings. Yeah.
I know. I mean, he's... God, the human soul. Who gets to look into the human soul, man? I think it's really gratuitous to even
only
think about
neurologists.
It.
Only neurologists.
Only neurologists can ask this question.
Everybody else.
Yeah.
All you artists and writers.
Exactly, man. Exactly. Oh my gosh, Jonah. This gal was in here. She was talking about, and she's really, I like her a lot, and she likes me a lot, and she's trained in psychology, and she's saying, I was saying, Living alone is hard, and I was saying that, I get these, really bad nights where like I'm like taking all the energy I can, to kind of get back and get on top of, nightmares and all this stuff, and how nice it is to have the divine help and like kind of help you out a little bit, right? And she says, yes, when somebody is under extreme stress and they start, kind of fighting against, they will generate endorphins and serotonin and all these things to help them kind of get their chin above the raging waters, right? And once they get free of it, they still get that kind of afterflow of, of endorphins. And I went, hey, I'm with you all the way. I'm with you all the way, baby. Whatever you want to call it, So yeah. What was Everett Ruiz on, man? Endorphins, serotonin. What was, getting him across the desert?
Endorphins for sure.
Doing endorphins for sure.
Yeah.
And doing all this great art. And God, but I mean, really, Jonah, I've looked at that country and been in it, and I've never traveled across it on foot. I mean, I just can't imagine the amount of courage that this man had, jeez.
Well, it's also a kind of young courage, right? I mean,
Mm-hmm.
like that would be the perfect time to do it.
Right.
When I went for my hike today, it was like at a certain point, I reach a point where I'm like, okay, I don't know how I could see beauty in anything right now. I'm just kind of tired. And like, if I did this all day, I would be, I would just be thinking about, earning my beer, basically,
Yeah,
right?
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And isn't that what we do? That's enough. I'm so glad you mentioned that, because reading this today and skimming through the Roberts book, a few weeks ago, I mean, if you really put yourself in his eyes and his spirit, and coming across, from the es from the Escalante, Davis Gulch, and then you come, if he did stand on top of that ridge above the Colorado River and look at the river he's going to cross, right? And seeing that big river and where he's going to cross it and everything, and what's on the other side of that and everything. I think it's really fantastic, man. I think it'd be a great movie. I really do.
Well, they've tried to make two that they have in the David Roberts book. Is like there was one, the granddaughter of Dorothea Lange, she made one,
Oh my gosh.
which Roberts described as being very not true to life. It just like made a lot of stuff up, basically. And there was another one that Ruiz's brother Waldo, who lived to be the opposite of Ruiz, he lived to be like 97. He died in 2007. So he sent this to a woman who worked for like 17 years, and she eventually made one that's like a mix of documentary footage and a young actor playing Ruiz, which
But not with like Scorsese or somebody
no, nothing like that.
doing the cinematography,
Yeah, nothing like that.
where, yeah, no, I was, I'm so glad that you talked about doing this, because just having been down there a few times, it was like, gosh, I'm just kind of seeing, gosh, you're 18 years old and you've been crossing the slick rock. I mean, this country is like knobby, but the knobs are like 50, 70, 80 feet high, and canyons and side, you know how it is to walk on side stuff,
Yeah.
to find a little, I mean, I'm just so astounded. And but just that vision of standing over the Colorado River and looking at Monument Valley to the south and just wondering, oh gosh, I just got to get across the river, and then what's going to be there, I've actually had kind of, I rarely get kind of a mystical feeling when I'm reading something, but today I kind of got it.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool, man.
Well, that was something else I kind of wanted to touch on, and why I brought that Andy Dillard Pilgrim at Tinker Creek book mm-hmm. too was, because that subtitle of that is a mystical journey into nature, and like how mysticism is connected with nature writing in that sense of like the true mystic is involved with nature in a distinct way, I think, really. Mm-hmm. Like, that's where most mystical writing comes from, basically, is from nature writing, I think. I don't know. I mean, like, I don't have anything to prove that or anything.
If you look at the Italian masters, yes, they're always in a natural setting. Mm. Now, Mary and the baby, you know, like that, yeah, they're surrounded, but the mystics, St. Francis, Sebastian, or whoever, they're always out in the rocks, man.
And could we chalk this up to endorphins? I mean, could we chalk this up to...
Well, they've said that it was no accident that the three great Western religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, were in the desert.
Mm.
And
that's a good point.
Just this essential sun, rock, and a trickling of water here and there, and the but the endurance of life, you know. I mean, when life figures out how to live in the desert, you can learn something from it. it's figured something out, right?
Yeah.
And this elemental, but this, I think it's the triad, the triangle of the heat of the sun and the rock and this glimpse of water, you know, is that's the essence of religion, right?
Yeah. And that's why I've always thought that people don't get when they reject mysticism is that there is a sense of mysticism that is trying to figure things out.
Right.
You know, like...
Right. Right. You're right. There's no transport. Right. There's always an element of, you know, yearning and the illusion of thinking, yeah, I could get it, but I see the elements. I might not understand them, but I see the elements.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, so this is a page, this is from Annie Dillard, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, which, I don't know, I love this cover. This is so not a podcast thing, because nobody can see this, but she has this shock of white hair that's blowing over her face that almost makes her look like she has
fetlock.
Fetlock.
Jewish.
That was great. No, yeah. sideburns.
Sideburns. Jewish sideburns.
He won up me. But she wrote, I don't know what it is about fecundity that so appalls. I suppose it is the teeming evidence that birth and growth, which we value, are ubiquitous and blind. That life itself is so astonishingly cheap, that nature is as careless as it is bountiful, and that with that extravagance goes a crushing waste that will one day include our own cheap lives. Like, you know, and that's like the paradox of mysticality, right? Is like, it's seeing a truth, but it's also, it's a yearning for that, but it's also... seeing that doesn't get you anywhere or whatever, yeah.
That was such an unconscious segue, though, from what I was talking about.
So sorry. Yeah.
Because she's talking about fecundity and exuberance, right? And that's what I'm saying. In the desert, it's like,
yeah,
boom.
Yeah.
I mean, boom. You can feel the heat of the sun. You can see the heat radiating off the rock, and you see these little wildflowers here and there, or a brush here and there, or a cactus, right? And cactus flowers, how spectacular they are, right? Yeah, that's a great segue. And I think that something between what we're talking about, there might be some truth in here about how we respond to the divine, right? Is the divine in all this exuberance and da-da-da, right? Or does it happen in a certain amount of limitation and compression, where you're kind of like, okay, how am I going to live, man?
Yeah.
How am I going to create my life, the energy to live right now, you know. And
well, you've created another problem.
In the desert, you feel it. You really feel it in the desert, man.
Oh, well, the sun. I mean, the sun is the big one, right? I mean,
yes, boom, man.
I mean, I think you know this as well as anybody. It's like just having that strong sun on your face. I mean, that's just. There's people. There's basically the reason people go to the beach and everything is like the sun is just.
Right.
I mean.
Right.
I don't know if I've repeated this before, but I remember one day I was like just coming off mushrooms and I've been driving all night and I came up and I was watching the sunrise and I was just thinking about how the fact that the sun is the only reason any of these things are happening, any of the reason any of us are here at all. And then you just see people like pull onto the highway and they're just going to their jobs and they just look tired and bored. And you have this moment where you're like, Jesus, like what are we missing here? You know?
And
it's kind of a boring observation though, too. I think that's what people have the problem with mysticality is
it is not boring at all. I mean, that is the point, is that in the desert, you know, like in my third novel, I mean, which is set, you'll be very proud of me. I was reading Critical Theory, and this French guy talks about how, you know, in a narrative you've got chronology and then you've got the narrative, right? And in my novel, the chronology is set against the Iraqi war, so that allows in the narrative me to bring in these returning Iraqi veterans. And they talked, one of them talked about how you're in this vast crystalline sand desert and that sun comes up not at the northern latitude but more of a southern latitude, and it comes up like now and boom, the whole desert turns blood red. Boom. And you're going, okay. Right?
Yeah.
And it's not even hot yet, but it's like, and he said that the waves of red light just flow across that desert, man. And he said, you know, I almost made it all worthwhile to have seen that. Of course, I had to put it in my novel. I might have had to write the third novel just for that one image, right? But
I mean,
that is the point, though, Jonah. And that is why mystics like Everett Russ are so vital, you know, because, and you. Because, wait a second, all these people are getting in their cars and starting it up, and they never look at the sun. In the desert, you do.
Right.
You're a pastoralist.
Yeah.
Yes, you are a pastoralist. There are no trees around. You know, you maybe wake up your goats or whatever and go out. But when that sun comes up, man, you're kind of going, thank you, Lord, man. Thank you, Lord. It's all going to happen again, isn't it, man? Right. And out of the starry night, but there's nothing. You know, the starry night is great, but man, when that moon, when that sun comes up in the desert, it's like the real deal, man. And what is it? It's a sacrilege not to feel that when the sun rises, you know? I feel that totally. That's
why. Well, you're the one that gets up every morning with the sunrise.
It is, man.
Yeah.
It's like, boom, man.
It's too powerful to me, honestly. I wrote a poem once. It was like, well, when I get up that early, it fucks up my whole day. Because I wake up and boom, I'm there. And by 9 o'clock, everything is drained for me. I'm like, oh my God, now I have to live the rest of this day? Like, yeah. What the hell? Like, you have this powerful moment, and then the rest of it is just...
Well, now you know why 5 or 6 o'clock, man, and these pretty babes want to go dancing, or, you know, everybody wants to go party, and I'm going, gosh, man, you're right. It's true. I mean, by 11 o'clock, I'm pretty much through with the day. I mean, I'm trying to get my way through here. You know, read a little bit, open this store. That's about it, man. God, I love this time of year, though. It means I am up working at 5 in the morning. That first light comes, man, I'm like up and I'm just going, man. I love it. If I just had a little elevator to the top of this building so I could just go up there, you know. You know, I would probably get more energy. I think it's just the fact that the sun is deflected that I'm not getting a. I'm getting the image, the idea of the sun, but I'm not getting the full energy blast. You know, I actually saw Dennis Prox at the Glenn Allen's wake, and he does these beautiful wrought iron stairwells, and I was almost going to go over to him and say, you know, I'd kind of like a stairwell up to the cupola here in my skylight. I think if I went up there every morning,
yeah,
I think it'd be real good for me.
How much do you think that would run you?
It doesn't matter because I got nothing but money.
I never. We don't need your money, podcast listeners.
We are going to persist. But send us some encouragement.
How about some weed cookies or something? Yeah. That'd be good.
Yeah.
Well, we got a little off track there. Maybe a bit.
I think this was the best yet, man. This is the best podcast yet.
Okay, I got one more one more wrench to throw in your in your spokes.
Okay.
So This is something I wrote. Well, I was, and you, I know this is not your bag, but I know you're capable of it.
Mm-hmm.
So you gotta call me out on my pretentiousness.
Okay.
So this is a note I wrote to myself while reading the Everett Ruiz book.
Great.
Truth is trauma. Consciousness is no more inclined to pure truth than pure water. Than pure water is inclined to the brain. It saps electrolytes. One needs the impurities. Such is the tantalizing desire for mystery, which some may misinterpret as a search for the truth. Solidity is not as truth per se, because to be solid is to only be a single kind of matter, not to be, you know, pure water. I'm linking to water, vapor, gas, which at the very least, there are two different types. Yet to flirt with truth, to let it exist in one's rearview mirror, this is absolutely necessary for the compunction of time. The same way that trauma is essentially unavoidable, the truth of time will catch us all. Not too pretentious?
It's brilliant. It's totally logical.
Well, I'm sort of obsessed with the idea that truth is
this
trauma.
Is like Immanuel Kant would go, yeah, I agree with that. You develop it very well. It's tremendous, man.
Well, people talk about the truth all the time, and I feel like they
you
don't.
Keep it in your rearview mirror, man. That's where you want to keep it, you know, the corner of your eye. I love the metaphor of the impurities in the water. I mean, that's you. That's really tremendous, man. And ending with time, you never lose that. That's why we got this great podcast, right?
Yeah.
This is, yeah.
I wrote it, and then I was like, I'm not sure where I could ever use this in the book I'm currently writing, so I just decided to read it on the podcast.
It's just one of them damn extended epigrams.
Yeah, too epigrammatic.
It is. It's fantastic, man. I love you ending with time, though.
See, yeah. This is not what I want. I want a little feedback. I want a little spine on my rose butt.
No, man, you get the bouquet, man. That's a great piece of writing, man. It's a great piece of writing, and. Yes, in terms of looking at the life of Everett Ruiz, it's absolutely appropriate, man.
Well, yeah, I was just thinking.
And
about
the idea of mystery.
Yeah.
Mystery is an impurity in this. And going back to that bit of adolescent polemic that Roberts denigrates, right? That's what Everett Ruiz is talking about, man. You know, it's.
Yeah, if you're so convinced of the truth and you start trying to throw yourself on its fire,
yeah.
you've misunderstood the whole point of it.
Oh yeah, man.
Like,
And I like that. And again, back to the fire. Yeah, the truth gives you energy. But don't fucking try, you know, live by it or make other people live by it. That's not going to work. And I mean, truth. I mean, how do you write? So is there a writer that has like written like truth? You know,
I think that's
see, people say Hemingway did.
Yeah. Well, I can see that. My problem essentially has always been with Hemingway is that he doesn't get inside his characters' heads enough, which to me is closer because it gives the validity to not just their actions but how they think about things.
Right, and it gives you the illusion of truth because he creates it. But how? Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people who would argue that your actions are the only thing that matters, but I just don't subscribe to that at all.
Right. Exactly. So. Yeah.
Although, you know, in the case of Everruis, his actions perhaps speak louder than his words in his sense of immortality, or how Stegner calls him artist in residence of that part of the country. There's nobody who could write a poem that would be more interesting than traveling around with two burros by yourself for 3 years. You know, it's like...
No, no, that's what I was saying when I was going back to the cinematography. Jeez, come on, man. I mean, we spend like 4 or 5 days, 4 or 5 hours in the wilderness, come back to the sleeping bag, you know, and it's like you're just so suffused with the stupendous beauty of the earth, man, where it hasn't been despoiled, right? Like the craters of the moon. And
impossible to be despoiled like the craters of the moon.
I don't know.
It'd be pretty hard
I'm getting it would be easy to despoil the craters of the moon.
What would they do?
But I'm getting at the end of this Green Skies Hazy IPA. So, no, I love that, I don't know what we call it, but basically it's a... philosophical statement, man, and it's totally solid, and I love the way it ends with time, you know. And I was thinking that's why I did the cut thing. I mean, you end the podcast with that piece of writing, and it's tremendous.
But it eliminates the point of the podcast. I think the one of the draws of the podcast is like, you know, the reality of sitting and talking in the I don't know, that's another thing that's tantalizing about the podcast.
It has no rules, it is ostentatious to end with a great piece of philosophical writing.
I don't want to...
So you rebelled against this. Yes. And I think you're right.
If it's too performative, it's
exactly so, man. Yeah, well, and then you bring up the idea of art. I mean, art has ritual endings, right? But this is a podcast. They're two different damn things, man. Yeah.
Does art have a... Well, I'm going to challenge you on that one. Does art have a ritual ending?
Oh, yeah. You always want to end one. You want to end with a great line. You know?
But how many books... ending lines do you remember?
Oh, all the great ones. I remember the last lines.
Really?
Oh, sure.
Okay, I'm putting you on blast.
Well, I can't remember, but the last paragraph of Fathers and Sons by Turgenev is just like, boom, man. I mean, it has all the solemnity and logical progression that your paragraph had. And it ends with time, you know, and they're at the grave of the son whom they love. He's an only child, right? And boom, it just ends like that, right?
Hmm.
And so, no, you don't want commentary after that. Of course not, because it's art.
That's true.
And it's ritual.
But you've also had, Fathers and Sons is a pretty big book, right?
It's not a big book. It's actually a pretty modest book.
300 pages?
by its scope, it's pretty limited. I mean, it's nothing like, you know, War and Peace or Dostoevsky or anything like that. There are only a few characters. But, I mean, I will return to this. I mean, ritual, art is ritual. And from the earliest dawn of man, whether it was dance or poetry or music, it always had this sacred ritual space to it, right? I mean, as Nietzsche taught us, in tragedy, what tragedy meant was you were in the room with the god, and it had a beginning, boom, and it had an ending, and then the god left, right? So it's this sacred limiting space that that is essential, right? And you know, most good writers, they'll end a chapter with something that you kind of remember, right? So Joan and Will write a novel like a podcast, which every dramatic moment ends with a kind of declining conversation or commentary.
No, that was great. That's great. I mean, I was so in agreement with that. I was just like, okay. Yeah, but I mean, maybe that's a bad part of our podcast. It was like we understand those things on such a similar level where you were saying it. I was just like, well, it's like I can't say it any better myself. So I'm just gonna.
It goes without saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is a postscript that it was worthwhile, man. We got to get into really the basic truths. You know. This is the service that we provide for our readership is we provide essential truths periodically.
Well, except now I'm conflicted by the word truth, and now I can't turn to like Spinoza, I can't turn to Kant, I don't know who I can turn to about the word truth, you know, because the word truth is in and of itself. Paradigmatic. What's the word? Conundrum, I guess.
It's a label.
It's a label.
Socrates would cringe. He would go, "Truth? Wait, what are you guys?"
Socrates
was sleeping through the whole podcast, and all of a sudden he went, "Wait a second,
truth."
That would be a great skit for next time, man. It's too bad we're not televised, man. Who would we get? We would get Tom Straw as Socrates, man. He would be great.
Or Tom Waits.
Tom Waits. Well, in the relative sense, I must defend my phrasing. In the relative sense of the idea of perennial truth, lacking any other framing or guideline, what we just talked about is true. I mean, it's going to work for you. And I contend that totally, man. And I stand by our podcast.
Yeah, but truth, but that's what the point I was making is truth is trauma. Like,
yes, that was the best opening line.
Yeah, it has the benefit of also being alliterative, which I like.
Yes. I did not notice that. Yes, thank you. Thank you, Maestro.
But I think it's true, and what most people don't examine is that most people don't want the truth, really, you know. That's a heavy one. That's an 8%er.
But heavy discussions need heavy coolant.
It's like now we're gonna bring in our next guest, a diesel mechanic. welcome.
We'd get a hell of a lot of listeners with this.
just got to get a get enough of the listenership and get people hanging in the wings.
Boy, is that good. No, that's tremendous.
And this is the part of our podcast where we leave you to sit and reflect on what you've just heard.
And have a cold deadlift Imperial IPA from Widmer Brothers. And listen to this again at your leisure, out on your boat, out on the river, fishing.
If you have a boat, you are completely willing to, or completely invited to stop by our studio, and to we will give you art tutorials, and you can.
You know, that's a good idea, man. I've got to find a book of all his. Has anybody done a folio of his woodcuts?
No, there's not any in the Finding Everest, which I was kind of hoping there would be, but there wasn't. Yeah.
Right. So there are quite a few in Vagabond for Beauty, and they're fantastic, man. So this is
woodcuts with him using a knife and like cutting a block of wood.
Right.
I mean, I went to an exhibition once that showed the classic Japanese technique for woodcuts, which was obviously probably more advanced than just using a blade on a block of wood. But
same thing, man. The only difference between a block of wood and metal is the fineness of the lines, you know.
Well, with the Japanese, it was about like pressing different cuts of the same thing. So you'd do a cut of the trees,
right?
And then that would be its own separate block.
Sure,
print that. And
Thank you. You're absolutely right. Yeah, Rus just does a monochromatic black and white, we think, but nobody knows. But you know, at the very least, man, we'll just copy all of his stuff in Vagabond for Beauty, and then just pirate him, man, and. Put some of his poetry in there and do a book, man. I think he's a great artist, man. And
well, and that's one of the things that Roberts likes to point out is like, yeah, he probably could have been a great artist. I mean, he acknowledges that there's very few great artists who have died that young and still have the qualification of being good. You know, like there's
none that young.
Yeah, he points out like a couple from.
They all make it through the 30s anyway.
Yeah.
No, it's the Everest story has all the competence of great tragedy and yet great transcendence. You know, and going back to your idea of the mystical, man. I mean, the guy just like. Walks into the and becomes vaporized by the mystical. It's like the physical world. You know, the most beautiful country ever. You know, geez, we got to do a drive down there, man. We got to get in the car with Stacy and I've been talking to Heidi a little bit. I think we could. We just need a nice V6. You know, with lots of room in it and room for a bar in the back. I'll drive early in the morning.
I'm.
But yeah, go down Highway 89 to Bluff and drive out into all these places. I mean, they're all pretty much there. Bluff is on the southeast side. And Escalante and all that is on the northwest side, which is easier to get to. All you do is get on the freeway and just zoom down through Salt Lake City, Ridgefield. It was fun to read all those little towns. The post offices that he left letters for were all little towns that I hung out in.
Yeah.
Salina, Ridgefield, da-da-da, da-da-da.
Yeah.
And we could zoom down there like in no time. Yeah.
I am highly compelled to title this Vaporized by the Mystical. Maybe I should just start calling it random things instead
Eat
of
your
actual.
heart out, Wallace Stegner.
Nice. Eat, or, I mean, that's almost better. Eat your heart out, Wallace Stegner. That's almost better. Damn it.
That's tremendous. Don't lose that. As you know, I'm always in favor of ink and paper, as opposed to the, you know,
digital
way, the broadband.
Yeah.
So.
How many things on ink and paper have you lost, though? I imagine it's.
They're all here.
No, I have seen you personally try and look something up from one of the notebooks that you read it, and been like, "Oh no, it must have been in another."
Retrieval is not existence. Retrieval is merely a phenomenological perception of objective reality. I haven't thrown anything away. I've got everything back there. It's just a matter of that I'm not going to try and find it. But I actually had a dream the other day. Is it'd be really nice if I find a girlfriend and we live back there, that the first thing she's going to say is, "Wait, you've got like 40 cubic feet of notebooks back there and paper. Well, let's just make a bonfire." And I'll go, "I'm with it." And we'll just go out there and just fucking burn all that. I've got stuff back there I wrote in my late 30s. So that's 40 years.
Wow. I thought you said you lost most of that.
No, I lost it all before.
Oh, before that.
But once I got married, marriage is good, man. You just start throwing stuff away. You stay in one place, you know? You got a woman to keep you in one place.
Well,
and you don't move.
Like, this is one of my weaknesses. I think Louis C.K. had a joke about this. He said, "Sometimes I just like rereading my own emails better than I like reading other people's emails." That's one of my weaknesses too. Is like sometimes I'll just read something I wrote and be like, "Damn, this is good." Like, "Why doesn't anybody like this? This is great." I don't know.
And we're looping back to the beginning of Everett Ruess. Everett Ruess is writing these diaries totally self-consciously as an artist, and something he wants saved.
But he also has the benefit of being out on the desert in these places.
Right.
You know, how many hours a day? And then when he sits down to write,
right.
he has all this stored consciousness.
Yes, yes.
That has been gathering while he's been walking. And then while that happens. And, you know, that's the opposite of what most people do when they're on the internet all the time, is you're getting all this like random information.
Right.
Like, you go out and you let some stuff kind of percolate, sift in.
Well, that's the point. His diaries were the vehicle of his consciousness. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a big point. And,
well, it's the only thing that makes diaries interesting. I mean, because I think a lot of people try and, like, sort of lie or quasi-lie through their diaries to some extent. I don't know. There would be a good question of whether he ever thought his diaries would be read by anybody.
I know he did.
You think he did?
Oh, I know he did.
What? How do you know that?
They were the vehicle. Because a lot of those lines are like lapidary. They're pruned. They're clean, man.
Mm.
And you said it perfectly. As his consciousness, you know, over a whole day of 12 hours, he's like putting it down to like a paragraph or two in a letter. No, he's honing it down pretty good. And it's all what vehicle you choose to express your consciousness, which is the essence of art. I mean, whether you're a painter, musician, dancer, whatever. I mean, and to the extent that you are free and conscious of your gifts to do it, right? And discipline, too.
But a diary is a sort of undisciplined entity inherently. I mean, that's kind of what it was. It's never supposed to be a discipline.
I've never done a diary.
Yeah.
Never done a diary. It was too hard for me. It's interesting, though, Jonah, that Mike Stubbs came in, who's a really good writer, and I picked up David Sedaris's diary. And it's like, And I put a $10 price tag on it because I knew it was money, and he bought it right away. Because David Sedaris really worked on his journal. Every, like, 50 or 60 words, like just a paragraph, it's like perfect.
Huh.
He worked hard.
He worked hard on
hard stuff. On that paragraph, man. Yeah. I don't know what else he was writing, but he made sure that he wrote down in his journal diary.
Well,
yeah.
Perhaps this is another indication that Devin Lewis is gay. I'm glad that made you laugh. That's what I was going for.
Could possibly.
Like caring a lot about your diary. You know, maybe there's some kind of connection there. I don't know. It's very possible.
Oh. The adolescent girls, we've lost all our adolescent girl listeners, man. They're like, fuck you.
No, I'm not against it in the least.
I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. It is a girl thing to keep a diary.
Well, yeah. It's sort of feminine, and it's but it's also that idea of being listened to, but also not of knowing you want an audience, but trying not to acknowledge that audience as a reality of some kind.
This is why our podcast is so affecting, is that we have random young people wandering in here in Florida and then leaving noisily, especially when I made the remark about the girls in diaries. That was a little sexist.
No, I think that one was good. I think that's a pure.
It's true though.
Yeah,
it's
true. It's a pure.
All the women as a bookseller, Jonah. Just about, if I mention to very intelligent, sophisticated women who come in here, whether they write, and they all say, "I write a journal."
Yeah.
They all do, man.
Yeah. And that was the thing I learned with strippers too. It's like that kind of self-expression that, right. They wouldn't be satisfied without
right.
some version of self-expression.
Get even close to the four or five different. We didn't even get close to solving the mystery. Now, if a good police detective had really looked at this, he could have figured out what happened.
I doubt.
But alas,
I doubt it. Right? I mean, that's one of the things in David Roberts' book is. That the FBI comes to this crime scene and they sort of fuck it up.
40 years later.
Yeah, before the archaeologists
get. No, the original crime scene, they could have found it. If somebody would have gone there, they would have found it.
Right.
Of course, they didn't know. It was like a 3-month gap. And there was no, let's face it. And
the crime scene was never found. So they can't.
The crime scene was like 100 square miles.
Yeah.
But the point is, yes. If a police investigative team had been sent to that area, they would have found out what happened. But
right, if the crime scene could
but
have been
years
found.
Passed. I mean, no crime crew was. I've been reading Martin Beck, you know, and
right.
and no, I mean, this the last one I read. This is a gentle listener. This is. Mad Sjöwall and Per Wahl in Stockholm. And the one I read is that at the end of it, basically the two detectives are saying that, and this is incomprehensible, the whole thing, how they figured out. But they said if he hadn't done these one or two, three little careless things between Hungary and Stockholm, do you think we would have caught him? And the other guy says, yeah, we would have. See the crime scene, are able to follow the tracks, the time, and get out and interview people who are still alive in the vicinity. See, nobody talked to anybody in the vicinity. There were like 8 or 9 people in that 100 square miles.
Yeah.
None of them were talked to
immediately. Well, they also had good reason to not talk. Right.
Exactly so. But that's what a good police investigator says, is, well, where were you? Do you know him, right? And then you talk to other people. And then you put pressure on the other people. Well, Joe said he hadn't been there, but... And you see the guy kind of fidgeting. Yeah, I don't know. I was with my girlfriend over here, right? I mean, it's really interesting. Martin Beck is, I think I could be a police investigator.
Yeah, but you're not. And that's the point. You know, that's the point with all these stories, is they're all fiction. I mean...
Oh, no! Oh, no, Jody! Don't say that!
Oh, I mean...
Fiction and truth.
Yeah.
So great, man.
Well, I mean, it's some ridiculously high percentage... 98% of all convicted murderers confess.
Right. That's the point.
You know,
that is the point. But there's got to be some preliminary investigation to establish alibis, placement, da-da-da.
Yeah.
And that's the point, yeah.
Well, it's a more interesting story,
right,
because
right.
you engage with mystery, which it's got the first two letters of, or three letters of mystical.
Exactly,
you know,
so.
I think that's a connection between your interest in nature and your interest in mystery stories.
Right.
Is there's
right.
something similar
right.
going on.
So for our next podcast, this was True Crime, Southern Utah. Jonah has totally refused to accept my desire that there be a murder at the Craters of the Moon. Which, yes, he does, and he's right. He's right, but it's true. I want there to be a murder at the Craters of the Moon. And I tried to get him to help me investigate this, and he declined. He said no. But I think we still ought to write a good article about it sometime.
Make one up. Make one up. You know,
yes.
Having
gone to the hard bedrock of truth.
I mean, I think there is legitimately some good reason that I know there's probably no one listening that would take this to heart or have any resources to do this. But there is a legitimately good reason that like a Western movie or a mystery could be shot at Craters of the Moon. That would be totally unique and fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's good reason for that, and I could happily be involved with a script, but
really?
I'm just not going to write a script that I'm not being paid for.
Yeah.
I'm past that point in my life. So, it's like, if I'm going to write something, I'm going to write something mythological.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I don't.
Yes.
I don't want to write a script that's never going
to
be.
So it comes down to truth and money.
Yeah.
So you know what? I think we should go across the street, and I'm going to buy you a at the Star Route. He's got this Louisiana bratwurst.
All right,
let's go and do that.
All right, let's do it.
You hiding?
Hi.
Hi.